Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
And here comes part two of our two-part series, Dar Jamail, journalist and author, talking about his new book, The End of ICE. And today's podcast is my interview with Dar Jamail on February 2, 2019, at the First Presbyterian Church of San Anselmo, California. In this discussion, we touch on the dangers of permafrost melting, which could produce a cataclysmic climate event. We're also going to talk about the personal dilemmas we face as humanity considers possible extinction. And with sea level rise, as people move to higher ground, will all communities be treated equally? These are powerful questions we'll explore. And it's all made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions, including Jeff Lipinski, Jim McHugh, DGL, and Andrew Harnack. You can join them. Start your own subscription today at peterbcollins.com. Click on menu, then click on Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign-up page, and I think you can take it from there. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting my work. That was a great presentation and a good reflection of your book. I read every page. I bent back pages. I marked passages that I was going to quote. And Dar used every single one of them.
No.
So now I have to shift to the hard-hitting part. Dar, you're a journalist. Your book suffers from a major defect. It's not balanced. You don't even have a throwaway quote from Myron Abell, the oil industry's mouthpiece from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the leading source of climate change denial information. What's wrong with you?
Was there a question in there? Next question.
Okay. Would you agree, as a member of the media, that the mainstream media in this country has actually backslid in its coverage of climate change issues? That 5 to 6 years ago, major outlets like the New York Times had a dedicated climate science reporter. And now we get the false equivalency reports, where an IPCC report will include a throwaway quote from Myron Abell.
Right, and this is the problem with the media and has been for a long time now, this whole idea of the myth of objectivity and balance. And the reality is that if you look at the hard science about what's happening. This is why you're not going to see a lot of the information that I shared tonight in the mainstream media. And I would add that as of late, in general, as of late being probably over the last year-ish, the Washington Post and the New York Times have been starting to do a lot better job.
Yeah.
However, if we look at the television networks, which is where most of the dominant society, most of the mainstream culture gets their information, climate change is hardly even mentioned.
Well, we got to make room for all that Russia coverage.
Well, that and celebrities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a group that we both know well, Norman Solomon founded it with Jeff Cohen, and they do fantastic watchdog reports on the media. And it was in 2017, if I remember right, I'll ask you a question. What was the sum total time that all the major networks, ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox, et cetera, for the entire year together spent on climate change?
6 minutes and 45 seconds.
Ah, you knew it.
I made that up.
It was actually, it was under 7 minutes.
Really?
Good guess.
Huh. Wow. But who needs to know?
Who needs to know? It's the single biggest story on the planet, becoming increasingly more important every passing day, and it's being largely ignored by most of the media or grossly misrepresented.
Dar, you chose three locations that you cover in the book, and I'd like to complement that with a couple of others. You talk about the future of the forests, and it's very top of mind for us here in California after 2 years of deadly wildfires. You and I recently did a podcast about the Southern California wildfire called the Woolsey Fire, which we now know started at a federal facility, a decommissioned place called the Santa Susana Field Laboratory. This is another case of media malpractice, that there's been a little reporting by some Los Angeles media, but in general, most people don't know the origins of the Woolsey Fire, the toxic elements that were at that site. It was a nuclear test site. It was a jet engine test site. And you connected me with a former...
Dan Hirsch.
Yeah, Dan Hirsch from UC Santa Cruz, who started a project when he was at UCLA 25 years ago to try to close and clean up Santa Susana. And I'll compress the story. The work was supposed to have been completed well before the Woolsey Fire broke out. Talk a little bit about the impact of climate change on the forests and how it contributes to these wildfires, because there's still a lot of denial. People say, no, these aren't connected.
Right. So, and I preface this in the book and anytime I talk about this, so you can't ever attribute climate change as the only sole source for any event. I mean, standard disclaimer. But it is scientific fact, and there's loads of studies to show that as you warm the atmosphere, soils dry out, there's an increase in droughts, and it feels almost silly saying this to a California audience. And I have a lot of friends in the Bay Area that were sending me pictures from last summer, like, look, we can't even go outside. You know, the preponderance of forest fires is increasing dramatically around the world. And as I read that one statistic that with just a little bit more warming, they're going to, the amount of wildfires just in the U.S. is, in the western U.S. is going to sextuple. I mean, which is staggering given what's already happening. So we have increased drought, increased wildfires, and another thing with most people in here are probably familiar with the beetle infestations, pine bark beetles, and blister rust and other diseases like this that are increasing, all related directly to a warming climate. And so the beetles, for example, if they, under normal conditions, most of them winter over at the high elevations, 99% of them die out. But even just a little bit of warming, instead of if 99% of them die out, only 98% of them die out, which is roughly what's happening now, we have these incredible beetle infestations and millions and millions and millions of acres of forest being taken, that literally turned into just dry standing kindling, and then here we go, you know, insert spark here. And the West is riddled with it, British Columbia is riddled with it, and even where I live up on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, we're getting it now in Olympic National Park. So literally even parts of the rainforest that are getting it. So it's, these are just some of the impacts. And what I outlined in that chapter in trees, I went to Sequoia National Park and I went out with a USGS forester there, and what we found on that field trip, it just happened to unfold when I was in the field with him. We're walking around the giant sequoia, and I learned, you know, these are trees that normally they don't die. They grow so old and so big, they usually blow over in storms or things like this, and they have so much natural protection from wildfires and beetles that they live to be 3,000 plus years old. And we're out in the field and literally found a standing sequoia that was still alive. The researcher that I was with, we started looking around on the ground and picking up limbs, and it had beetle infestation. and it was the first time he'd ever seen beetle infestation in the sequoia. So now these trees, you know, these iconic trees, are now starting to look like they're going to be another victim of climate change.
In the part of the book where you cover these coral bleaching events, many people know coral reefs as beautiful underwater attractions. But what is the damage caused by the die-off in reefs? You write in the book that as much as 80% of the Caribbean reefs are gone. You talk about the sections of the Great Barrier Reef where you went diving, and you were pretty depressed when you were in the bleached out area, and you said you kind of, you know, quickly returned to the areas that still have life. But what is the ripple effect of the loss of reefs?
So coral bleaching, coral exists in a certain temperature range. It gets its beautiful colors from the different kinds of algae that are on it. That's where it gets its nutrition. When the waters warm up, that algae becomes toxic. The coral expels it so it doesn't die. And it can exist for like 3 to 4 weeks without that food source. And if the water cools back down, it takes it back in and it can live. But as I read about how dramatically the oceans are warming, 2018 just became the fifth year in a row that it was a record-breaking year of warmth for the oceans. So these thermal events, meaning these marine heat waves, are occurring more frequently across the globe. And coral occupies a tiny part of the ocean floor, but 1/4 of all marine species spend some part of their lives there. They play an integral role in marine food chains, and some scientists believe there could even be more biodiversity within corals than there is in the Amazon. So they're extremely important as far as biodiversity and numerous other, you know, economic impacts, tourism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, but we're losing coral. And the Great Barrier Reef, when I was there for the book, it was 2017. I was there for it was literally the first week of that year's major coral bleaching event, which ended up taking out 30% of the entire reef. This is the single biggest coral ecosystem on the planet. It's 1,400 miles long. The next year, another coral bleaching event took out 20% of the reef. That's 50% of the Great Barrier Reef in 2 years. Now, as we speak, yesterday, The Guardian releases a story. It has been a record. January was a record month for the entire country of Australia for record warmth. So you can only imagine the bleaching event that's going to hit this year. And you know, in conclusion, a 2011 NOAA report warned that at current trajectory, then we could have basically no functional coral reefs left anywhere in the world by 2050. And the scientists that I interview in the book, most of them thought at this point that is a completely dated report, and it's going to happen a lot sooner than that.
I want to take a second just to invite questions from members of the audience. We have some cards here that we'll pass out. When you have a question, write it down, pass it to the aisle, and we'll bring them forward, and we'll take a few of those a little bit later in our conversation here. Dar, the most disturbing element that you cover in the book is the risk of an accelerated climate change process. And as the glaciers melt, the permafrost is exposed. And the amount of methane that is stored in the permafrost is astounding. And this, to me, represents the potential for an unpredictable and cataclysmic warming event. Tell us more about that.
So that's exactly right. So the Permian mass extinction, which was the single biggest extinction event to date on the planet 252 million years ago, occurred when a giant volcanic eruption went on for thousands of years across Siberia and released enough CO2 into the atmosphere that it warmed the planet to the point where subsea permafrost, basically it's terrestrial permafrost that goes underneath the Arctic Ocean, and frozen within that subsea permafrost are methane hydrates. And once that permafrost thaws out and releases that methane, it bubbles up to the surface and it comes into the atmosphere. And Methane is 100 times more potent greenhouse gas than CO2 on a 10-year time scale. And it, in the Permian mass extinction, that released rather abruptly. And then that was really the driver that kicked that extinction event into high gear. And over 90% of all life on Earth got annihilated. And what we've done now in roughly the 250 years since the Industrial Revolution began is we've now put enough CO2 in the atmosphere that we're basically waiting for the warming to happen. It's happened so fast that glaciers are a canary in the coal mine. They're melting away. We're watching all of the beginnings of the, and what we're seeing right now is just the beginning. And so what's at risk now is, have we already put enough heat in the oceans and in the atmosphere that this these subsea methane hydrates are going to be released into the atmosphere? And disturbingly, in the book, I interview Dr. Ira Leifer, who's a scientist that's been studying this. He's done work with NASA, and he actually published a peer-reviewed scientific study that came out a number of years ago, an area in the Barents Sea, the shallow sea, where, for example, there is a normal background rate of methane plumes that come up out of the seabeds around the world. And in this particular area, the normal background rate of methane plumes in a 1,000-square-kilometer area was 3,000, I believe, if I remember right, it was 3,000 methane plumes. And his study found, using satellite measurements, that in a 1,000-square-kilometer area in that same region, they detected already 60 million methane plumes. And methane, there's enough methane trapped in the subsea permafrost that it would be the carbon equivalent of more CO2 than we've injected into the atmosphere to date since the Industrial Revolution began. And so we are at risk now, and I include another study of another scientist that warns we could actually see abrupt releases of massive amounts of this all at one point. And she warned, Natalia Shikova is her name, and she warned that this could literally happen at any time.
Dara, most people, I think, here are probably familiar with Guy McPherson. And you explained to me before we sat down tonight that when you began the book, you were in kind of a mindset that you compare to his, and you describe him as somewhat extreme and kind of a, I guess, the wizard at the Temple of Doom. And as I read the book, your own feelings shifted in several different directions. And as you end the book, you talk about being in grief and dealing with grief. It appears you started out very angry and, by your own description, somewhat judgmental. Talk about that evolution.
Right. So Guy McPherson is a brilliant evolutionary biologist who really, for me, connected all the dots of, it's not just about looking at, you know, scientific reports on Arctic trees, oceanic warming, coral, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but you have to kind of look at it in total. And he put together this essay, extremely heavily hyperlinked to all the different scientific reports, and pulled it all together and really showed, look, this is how far along we are. Look, all this stuff's happening all at once. It's been happening for a while. Here's all these feedback loops. And I'm always going to owe him a debt of gratitude for helping me kind of connect all these dots. And he was actually in that 2013 article that I mentioned, and I quoted him at length. But where I differ now with some of his analysis is, and I used to believe, like, putting all this together and think, look, it's over. We're done. Like, what's the point? We're off the cliff. And I spent a lot of time in that place. But what's happened in the book of going through this process and having to literally go say goodbye to some places, like going to places in Alaska where I used to hike across glaciers that were 300 feet thick, and they're completely gone in a matter of a decade. And having these direct experiences of loss and feeling these gut punches and the emotions that came with that. And then really coming back into the end. And this is why, really, the ending of the book and the events that led up to me writing the final ending of the book were so impactful, of meeting a person like Stan Rushworth, who sharing with me this idea of our obligations to serve the earth and our obligations to serve the next generations. And this doesn't cancel out how grim things really look and where all the science is pointing, but instead it's kind of shifted this thing inside of me that I, no matter how grim that looks, and no matter how almost certain it looks like things are going in that direction, no matter what, I feel like I have a moral obligation to the planet and to the next generations to still do absolutely everything that I can to try to fight, to try to conserve, to try to change this situation. And the other thing that really came into my consciousness is that Stan has pointed out, and there's studies to back this up, that, for example, there's an area where rattlesnakes were just being killed off by humans. Just, you know, they were trying to exterminate them from a complete area. And literally in one lifetime, the rattlesnakes started to then be born without rattles. So there was this abrupt adaptation happening. And then similarly, there was an area where elephants were being wiped out for their tusks. And literally in one to just a few generations, they started being born without tusks. Or they wouldn't grow, they stopped growing tusks. So it's like life is going to live, and it's going to adapt, and it's always going to try to live. And I write about this in my book about finding trees up on summits of mountains where they shouldn't be there. Like in the Olympic Mountains, in the summit, 2,000 feet above tree line, nothing but rock, and there's literally this scraggly tree just growing up out of a rock. And life is always going to try to find a way. And I'm not saying that this means for sure there's a guarantee that somehow humans are going to make it through this, but it leaves me in a place where it just kind of underscores the need for me to, no matter what, I feel obliged. And I think it's morally irresponsible. And I think if you look at it from the perspective of obligation to serve the earth and future generations, younger generations, anyone that thinks they're going to just sit back and, oh, well, what the hell, whatever, if you're not going to at least try, I find that repugnant.
At the same time, in the book, you describe that this research and reporting that you did for the new book was more difficult than war reporting. And I just want to underscore, without being too grisly, that Dar has seen the worst of humankind up close and in grisly color. And so that comparison carries a lot of weight.
Yeah. I did find that to be true. And part of it was going into war, of course, you expect war to be war. And I did see a lot of horrible things. And that was to be expected. But there was something about, and it's hard because I don't want to lessen the fact that, you know, over 1 million Iraqis plus have been killed since the invasion began in 2003, and then through the occupation, and to this day they're still dying as a result of U.S. policy there. But part of it is scope. I mean, as overwhelming as that is, and that number is, and that, you know, the policies of this country have literally completely destroyed not just Iraq, but now clearly a region, that we're talking about the whole planet this time, and we're talking about species that we are completely dependent upon. And if we consider the fact, author and storyteller Stephen Jenkinson talks about the fact that there is no other species on the planet that's dependent on humans for its existence. Not one. We are dependent on every other species on the planet for our existence, period. So when we look at the impacts of climate change and species extinction, now for a long time it's between 150 and 200 species a day. We're looking at something between 1,000 and 10,000 times more than the normal background rate of extinction. We are in the sixth mass extinction. And if we put all of this together, and for me to just literally be out in the field and looking at trees and animals and birds and fish in the ocean, and to think that all of our combined actions and the fossil fuel industry is literally causing the extinction of all of this, and then going to a place like St. Paul and spending time with native populations that are living subsistence close to the land, their whole culture and spirituality tied to these things that are going away. In total, it's just been a much, much, much harder thing for me personally to try to deal with it. And then another layer to it is you know, my own culpability. You know, I mean, I drive, I fly, you know, we're wearing oil. All of us in here right now are wearing something. There's some oil in what we're wearing. You know, everything, our whole lives, our whole culture is built on it. And that's a really hard thing philosophically and spiritually to try to get okay with.
So as we face sea level rise, I just want to use Marin County as an example, because it's going to test a lot of our values. Sausalito is a wealthy community, and you can imagine that a lot of resources will be devoted to build seawalls and to otherwise try to retrofit that town for higher water levels. San Rafael's canal community, which is predominantly Latino, is roughly at the same elevation. And I'm not confident that we will provide the same resources to fortify or relocate those populations as we will those who enjoy wealth and advantage. How do we deal with that?
You're not asking me easy questions. it's complex. Some of the things that are already happening in other places. In South Florida, you know, we all know that coastal property is the most expensive. And there's now this kind of voluntary relocation of some of the wealthiest people living on the coast in parts of South Florida are now moving to higher ground in Miami, which up until recently has been the more affordable place. It's further from the coast. There's more working class people there and poor people living there. And now there's this gentrification happening because some of the people on the coast that see the writing on the wall are like, okay, I'm going to sell while I can still get my money back out of this place, and I'm going to move up to higher ground in Miami City proper. That's happening as we speak. Even Bloomberg has already run stories showing that the real estate bubble right now across Miami, that I think it's worth over $1 trillion, that bubble will pop long before the first drop of seawater actually enters someone's home. And I think the fact that these rich people are now already voluntarily moving away and moving to higher ground, I think it's the needle of the pin going through the membrane of that bubble. And so what happens when all of a sudden you have a real estate market that just completely crashes? And, you know, anyway, you can already look at what's happening. In fact, there's already banks in certain parts of South Florida that won't give 30-year mortgages. Now more direct, a different kind of direct human impact, like what I saw up on the north coast of Alaska. I have for the methane and permafrost chapter, I went up to town formerly known as Barrow. It was recently renamed the native name, which is Utqiagvik. It's the northernmost point in Alaska.
You needed a pronouncer in the book. I struggled with that every time.
Yeah. Inuit community. And there's 37 villages in Alaska alone that have to be relocated from thawing permafrost and coastal erosion and riverbank erosion. And Utqiagvik is the biggest village on the north slope. And when I was up there, they literally had a front loader maintaining a 20-foot-high berm across the coast of the village, because as the permafrost was melting and that was making the coast go away, and as the sea ice retreats, there was bigger waves, because now there's more area that wind can whip up bigger waves, and they were literally starting to erode the coast at a rate that they have to keep building this berm. And I watched a storm crop up while I was there and just started eroding the berm literally overnight. So this village is going to have to be relocated, and most of the people there are aware of the fact. We have a whole fresh set of climate refugees about to be generated in these 37 villages. Under Obama, there was a thing called the Denali Commission set up based in Anchorage that was tasked with relocating all these villages and finding funds, etc. Under Obama, one village got funds called Newtok. One. Now, under Trump, the Denali Commission's been defunded. It's gone. It doesn't exist. So these people are on their own.
What if he offered to build them a wall?
Yeah, right. Well, they have their dirt berm, but I guess he would want something else. But point is, there's going to be, as I talked about in that section with Harold Wanless in South Florida, you know, we're looking at hundreds of millions of refugees from coastal areas around the globe. There's a large amount of sea level rise already baked in to the climate system. And you know, the idea of adaptation to a city, the only adaptation would be houseboats. Because walls, you're building a wall against the ocean. You're pumping water, as was pointed out to me by the mayor Phil Stoddard of South Miami, that, you know, installing pumps around Miami Beach and places in Miami, if you're pumping that water into the ocean, you're pumping water uphill.
I'm going to tag on to a question coming from the audience here. You've touched upon population growth. How can we effectively get environmentalists and climate activists to discuss it? And to put it in a more personal frame, a friend of mine who's here tonight recently became a grandfather, and when I congratulated him, he kind of hesitated. And he said, well, I have mixed feelings because, you know, my child just brought another child into the world as we face possible extinction. These are really thorny issues.
Extreme. I mean, what could be more challenging to talk about? I personally decided not to have kids a long time ago. Part of that was I just never had a huge urge. Part of it was climate, politics, seeing what was coming. It's a very, very personal decision. I know for a fact, the fact is, if you want to have, you know, lower your carbon footprint, the single biggest thing you can ever do is not reproduce. The next things are don't fly, don't drive, and don't eat beef. But the reality is, with bringing children into the world, I've watched myself have intense judgment and condemnation towards people that I saw having kids and thought, wow, that's just reprehensible and selfish. How could you possibly consider such a thing? Since then, kind of given some of the things I talked about regarding not like necessarily the animal adaptation examples that I gave or the possibility of human adaptation, which is there, but not likely. It's really kind of left me in this place of if we maybe only have a finite time left as a species that's a lot shorter than we think, I don't know, who am I to say someone else should or shouldn't have a kid? But I think the thing that I'll end this with after kind of walking around the topic a little bit as I just did is that if someone's going to have a kid, I think it would be very important for them to consider first to think about, am I ready to bring a child into this world where regions are literally going to be uninhabitable? In this country, well before 2050, food and water availability are going to be very real daily issues for just about all of us. And am I willing to bring a kid and take responsibility for what that means into that kind of a world? And then have discussions with that child once that child is old enough and starts asking me, why am I here and why did you decide? I need to be ready to be able to explain that. And those are some of the things that I've thought about. This is a very challenging topic. I definitely intend to research it, and Barbara and I are actually going to write about it. We're actually starting a series of articles for Truth App. First one's going to run Monday. It's on grief. And one of the topics is going to be talking with children, and another one's going to be the decision to have or not have children, and start taking on some of these challenging things that we have to talk about, we have to look at this because this is the world that we live in now.
There are several questions about diet and agriculture, and I'll tie them together with my question is, as we see, for example, I like swordfish and halibut, and those stocks are declining. Should I enjoy my last swordfish and swear off it? Or should I, you know, accept that as long as it's available and they've already killed it? So, I mean, these are difficult issues to weigh, and I like swordfish.
Well, and it is, and I like scallops, and I like salmon, and you know, none of us are pure. All of us, you know, there's no way we can live in a way that's going to not leave a carbon footprint. We can get close to it, and I strive every year to get close to it. I live in a solar-powered house. I grow a whole lot of my own food. I reduce my carbon footprint on an annual basis, and will keep trying to do, I will keep doing those things. And I have adjusted my diet out to where I eat far less beef than I do. And I'm doing all these things to go in a better direction while I know that I'm far from pure. But I think these questions are, I mean, real. If we're going to be really responsible and really walk our talk, I think we, you know, once we become aware of the fact that this is a species that I could buy and eat, and this is a species that's on the way out, like, it doesn't make sense to keep doing that, frankly. It's just not. You know, if there's anything that we can do at all to give any part of the planet even just a 1% more chance of lasting even just a little bit longer, then we're morally obliged to do this. And here's what I broke it down to. So I was in a writer's residency writing the introduction to this book in 2015, and I have a really, really good friend named Nick Terry, and he's a Zen teacher. And he studied with Charlotte Joko Beck down in San Diego. Some of you might know of her. And a beautiful guy. And I was really struggling with the introduction because I was like, I was doing research at the same time. And I was going through one of those phases where it was like, what's the point? It's over. What's the point? And I was sitting there having coffee with Nick. And he says, you know, Dar, if you write this book and if all it does is it gives one little tiny organism in the Amazon rainforest an extra 1 week to live on the planet, it's worth it.
Let's see. I have a lot of questions here, and I apologize. Yeah. We will not be able to get to all of them. A number of people, one mentions that he or she has 7 siblings, and 4 of them believe that humans have caused climate change, and the other 3 are in denial. One just survived the Arctic vortex in Chicago and appears to be opening his or her mind a little bit. But let me tie that to a question. Do you think that climate change is too mild of a term? Should we call it more like it is? Climate crisis, climate catastrophe, impending extinction. Mm-hmm. So talk about that a little bit, please.
Yeah, the second one, I'll take the easier one first. The second one, that's why I use climate disruption instead of climate change. Part of that's to be scientifically accurate. Climate's always changed. The right-wing fossil fuel-funded meme on that is true. Climate always changes. But what humans have done is disrupted global climate. So that's a better term. It also has more weight to it than change. Climate chaos, you also hear. I agree with that. I think we need to be precise in how we talk about these things, and that climate crisis is another good one. People, deniers, when I'm feeling less spiritual and less centered and more angry, I have a family member who is a denier, and we don't go there. We don't have a very deep relationship. And I have extreme judgment, and I just have a lot of judgment. I'll just leave it at that. But when I'm feeling more spiritual and more centered, I just look out and I feel like we're all somewhere on the spectrum of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Five Stages of Grief. And I think we have to all exercise some amount of denial just to live in the dominant culture of this country, where, you know, we're all, like I said, most of us drove here, I flew down here, we're all wearing clothes with some oil in them or part of the process to manufacture them. So we all have a certain amount of functional denial, but we're all here at a climate change talk. I just wrote a book on it. So like we're somewhere on the spectrum of being, I think, you know, on the less denial end of the spectrum. And so from that perspective, people who are climate change deniers, they're just stuck in the denial stage of the five stages of grief. And I have seen those people that move through it. I mean, I literally have a good friend of mine whose father read my book. And this is like a Fox News guy, Rush Limbaugh, no climate change. And he read my book, and he's been forwarding me texts from his dad of like, I want to meet Dar, I want to shake his hand, I get it, climate change is real. And now he's bashing the media for not reporting on it enough and all of this. So change does happen.
A number of people ask about the negative political situation here in the exceptional United States. And other people are asking for ideas about what activists can do. One person asked for five. I don't know if you do listicles. You don't work at BuzzFeed. But any number will do if you'd like to suggest the most effective ways you think people can take action in the political system.
I'm going to share a story that I got from Stan, and it might sound like a cop-out, but I really believe in it. And this is why I share the Mies Mises story to end my talk, because I had to go through the grief when I really got the magnitude of the crisis that we're in, and then figure out what am I going to do and how am I going to be. And so Stan tells me this story of he brought an elder. It was actually Darrell Wilson while he was still alive who told him that Mies Mises story. And he brought him into his critical thinking class. And they were talking about a lot of intense things, you know, climate change, all these, you know, these myriad crises besetting us at this moment in history. And all the students started asking, you know, Darrell Wilson, like, well, what do we do? And he said, Darrell Wilson just pointed at his head. And he said, you have a brain, and you have information, and you know how to get more information, and you need to figure out for yourself what you need to do. And because you have to figure it out, and it has to come from in here, because we're going into such intense times that if you just do something because someone else said to do it, when things get really, really hard, you're not going to stick with it. And so it has to come from in here, and then you need to really seriously dedicate yourself to it. So I think that, thanks. I think every one of us is going to have a different response to this crisis, and it's going to depend on who we are and how old we are, where we live, or what we do, or, you know, if we have some extra money or if we don't. I mean, where we live and all these different things. And I think that it's an extraordinary moment. And I guess one thing I would add is that, you know, I feel very lucky that I can write books and write articles and all that and get information out. And that gets a lot of attention like this. But we need everybody doing, a lot of people, what they already do. We need cooks. We need alternative medicine. We need acupuncture. We need people farming, growing vegetables, we need permaculturists, we need people teaching kids, we need all that stuff, you know, and we need it all done better, and all of those things can be done in a way with the climate crisis in mind, so I would put that out there too.
Dar Jamail's new book is The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Thank you for being with us this evening.
Thank you, everybody.
Dar Jamail.
Thanks. Thanks, Peter. Thanks, everybody, very much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this conversation with Dar Jamail. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.